نغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا ربنا اغفر لنا ذنوبنا وإسرافنا في أمرنا وثبت أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord. So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair. And make firm our feet, and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world, and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
Good morning to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran radio broadcast from Tehran. Here are some interesting facts about Islam. The Islamic world produced the first skilled, specially trained pharmacists who made their own medicines and worked closely with medical doctors and physicians. A 13th century Islamic writer described the circulation of blood inside the human body some 400 years before this was discovered in Europe. One famous hadith Islamic saying is, Allah is beautiful and loves beauty. Beauty has always been, therefore, very important to Muslims and develops in the virtual arts such as architecture, calligraphy, painting, textile, metalwork, and ceramists were encouraged. On the continuation of Iran Radio, we'll listen to this part. We start off this hour's programs with our news bulletin. That will be followed by the Ocean of Dua. The program explains supplications and prayers taken from various books such as Mafatihul Jinan and Kamilu Ziyarat. And we round up this hour with our varied radio productions feature.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Israel presses ahead with its blatant violations of the Gaza ceasefire agreement, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians across the war-torn territory. Iran slams Western states for their approach to the genocidal war on Gaza. It also criticizes Western media outlets for distorting facts in covering the war. And an international human rights group has filed a complaint with FIFA's ethics committee over a peace prize awarded to Donald Trump. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, Israel's blatant violations of the Gaza ceasefire continue unabated, claiming the lives of more Palestinian civilians across the war-torn territory. According to Palestinian sources, Israeli tanks fired at civilians east of Deir al-Balah and in the Al-Tufa neighborhood of Gaza City. At the same time, the regime's artillery fire struck Gaza City's Al-Tufa neighborhood and the eastern areas of Khan Yunis in southern Gaza. A Palestinian civilian was killed by Israeli gunfire in Beit Lahia in northern Gaza, while a child was injured in an attack on displaced people's tents in Deir al-Balah. The child was among six Palestinians injured within 24 hours. The death toll from the Israeli genocide is now near 70,370, with more than 171,000 others injured. The regime's forces blew up several residential buildings east of Jabalia and in Beit Lahia, both in northern Gaza. They also detonated a residential complex in the Al-Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City. In the Shojaya neighborhood of the city, Israeli forces detonated an explosive-laden armored vehicle as the regime's gunboats opened fire off the coast of Khan Yunis. Qada Ibrahim is joining us now from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza with more updates on the situation from the Gaza Strip as the Israeli regime continues with its genocidal massacre against Palestinians in Gaza in violation of the so-called Gaza truce. Qada, what do you have to share with us?
Exactly. The Israeli violations are continuous, and the Israeli attacks are continuous as well behind the so-called yellow line in particular, in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city in particular, the eastern parts or the outskirts of Beni Sahela, Al-Qarara and Dabasan areas since the beginning of this day, or since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement. Until now, we are still hearing the artillery shelling targeting the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city, and the detonations of the heavy or the armored vehicles being detonated among the residential buildings and the remaining infrastructure in the eastern parts of Khan Yunis city. And also that is coupled with more gunfire towards the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah city, the eastern parts of Al-Maghazi and Al-Ibrej refugee camps. In the meanwhile, more attacks are taking place on the eastern parts of Gaza city, like Al-Sha'af, Al-Shaja'iyah, and Al-Zaytun neighborhood. And to the north of the Gaza Strip as well, more attacks are taking place, more artillery shelling, more air strikes and gunfire towards the people's homes and the shelters or the sheltering encampments in the northern parts of Gaza city. In the past 24 hours, one Palestinian woman was killed as a result of the of an Israeli fire that targeted her tent or targeted the place she was sheltering in, highlighting again how the Israeli occupation army is continuously attacking the people, not only behind the so-called yellow line, but also in areas outside the so-called yellow line. And on the ground, we are witnessing more areas like the eastern parts of Al-Sha'af and Al-Shaja'iyah, and also in Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis city, are being widened to be included more into the yellow line zones. The Israeli occupation army is widening its circle and its range of attacks to include more residential areas and more clusters or residential clusters in its circles of attacks. So the situation is really tense, and this is happening with the Palestinians, and while the population here are living and experiencing an unbearable humanitarian catastrophe and conditions. And nowadays, as the Byron storm is hitting hard and started to hit vast areas of the Gaza Strip, and it is expected to be by tomorrow, the situation is multiplying, or the suffering is multiplying for the Palestinians here. Many people are nowadays suffering, and the prominent picture in these days, the shivering hands of the children inside the tattered tents, because the vast majority of the Palestinians, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians, are nowadays sheltering in very tattered tents. And this is the third winter nowadays to come and to hit to these areas or the areas that are completely lacking all the basics of survival, and most importantly lacking the sheltering materials, as Israel's occupation regime is still obstructing and restricting the entry of sheltering materials into the Gaza Strip even after the ceasefire went into effect for more than 60 days now. So the situation is really very harsh, very difficult, and very unbearable, and the Gaza municipality and civil defense, the civil defense in Gaza City are warning that the situation is really very dangerous, and it is life-threatening for thousands or hundreds of thousands of families who are nowadays in shelter, in these sheltering tents or in these very weary and tattered tents in the western parts of Gaza City, like in Al-Mawasi area, like in a shelter refugee camp, and the western parts of the Gaza Strip.
All right, thanks a lot, Vlad Ibrahim, joining us from Deir al-Bala in central Gaza. Well, staying with Gaza, most families there are living in tents. They've built themselves, scraping together whatever wood pieces found to keep them standing. With Israel's blockade still preventing essential supplies from entering, many lose their shelters over and over again. In western Khan Yunis, a makeshift workshop has started repurposing wood to offer families an alternative. Ahmed al-Najjar reports from Khan Yunis in southern Gaza.
Across the crowded western areas of Khan Yunis, tents stretch as fragile shelters held up by one essential material, wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets, once lying discarded on the roadside, have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transform these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuild or reinforce their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the world must stand against the role of certain Western media that have aided in justifying Israel's genocidal actions in Gaza. Amir Saidi Ravani slammed those media outlets for distorting realities and using inhumane language. He made the remarks at a high-level General Assembly meeting held to mark the Genocide Prevention Day. Iravani emphasized that many Western governments have facilitated, legitimized, and even normalized the genocidal campaign in Gaza while they hide behind diplomacy. He said these governments have reproduced colonial narratives and Israel's distortion of international law. He pointed out that the International Court of Justice, in its advisory opinion, referred to what has happened to the Palestinian people in Gaza as genocide. The Iranian UN envoy underlined that Israeli crimes in Gaza cannot be justified, minimized, or concealed. Pakistan has also commemorated the UN Genocide Prevention Day, which fell on December the 9th. A seminar has been held in Islamabad to mark the occasion. Our correspondent Nasser Kazmi reports from the Pakistani capital.
Pakistan's capital, Islamabad, marked the International Day of Commemoration and Dignity of the Victims of the Crime of Genocide and of the Prevention of this Crime. A seminar was held bringing together former diplomats, members of parliament, think tank researchers, university faculty members, and students. Speakers reflected on historic and ongoing genocides targeting Muslim communities, saying Gaza today represents the world's gravest moral failure.
9th December, and by the United Nations, it's declared as the Genocide Prevention Day, and especially to pay respect to the victims of different genocides. I must appreciate all the people in South Africa and all the other different countries. Those have showed their courage to support this issue and to support the people of Palestine, and especially the students of different Western universities. They supported this issue more.
Participants described the situation in Gaza as catastrophic, urging Muslim countries to stand united to defend the rights of the Palestinian people. They said nations like Iran, which have shown firm diplomatic resolve and a strong stance against Israeli oppression, can send a powerful message to the world.
I think it requires the realization and united action by the entire Muslim community around the world. It is not only some people who raise their voices, and it is then forgotten. Iran has taken a stand which is a beacon of light for all of us.
Meanwhile, a Muslim unity conference was also held on the outskirts of Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Participants from diverse backgrounds rejected U.S. President Donald Trump's plan to end the war in Gaza, calling it a complete fraud.
The so-called peace promise made under Trump's leadership is nothing but a fraud. There is no ceasefire, the massacres continue, the genocide continues. Even the areas Israel was supposed to withdraw from remain under siege, and aid is still not reaching the people.
The participants emphasized that Gaza has become a defining test for the Islamic world, urging Muslim nations to take a united stand against occupation, injustice, and genocide of Israel.
Public anger keeps growing across Pakistan as the Israeli genocide in Gaza continues unabated amid international silence. Many fear that without global action, the catastrophic humanitarian crisis will intensify. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
The UK-based tea giant Lipton has officially closed its production in Turkey after 39 years transferring its factories to a local company. The move comes amid growing global boycotts targeting Israel-linked brands over the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Our Istanbul correspondent Ahmed Matip reports.
Boycott campaigns against Israeli and Israel-associated products and brands have intensified since the regime launched its genocidal war in Gaza. The UK-based tea brand Lipton is the last on the list, as the company's exit from Turkey marks one of the most visible outcomes of Gaza-related boycotts. For months, Turkish consumers have shifted away from brands perceived as financially or politically linked to Israel. That trend aligns with the wider global wave of economic pressure from South Asia to Europe.
The boycott is a strategic, economic, and psychological tool. Studies show that many targeted companies have suffered significant financial losses. Holding firms that support Zionism accountable is crucial, and we've seen international brands incur serious damage in Turkey and elsewhere. If the global economy can fuel wars, it can also help stop them.
Turkey's retail sector has experienced a clear transition. Shelves once dominated by global brands are now filled with local alternatives. Consumer awareness has grown rapidly since the war in Gaza intensified, driving a shift that industry experts say is both political and economic. Many Turkish shoppers say their choices are no longer about price or taste, but about solidarity. Despite economic challenges, consumers insist that refusing certain brands is a moral responsibility.
I boycott because I believe economic pressure can influence outcomes. Living in an Islamic country, I feel a duty to stand with Gaza and Palestine, and I encourage others to join, as weakening economic power can have real impact.
At international cooperation navigate growing pressure, Turkey's local tea and food producers are expanding rapidly into the vacant space. Analysts expect more companies to reconsider their regional strategies if boycotts continue gaining momentum.
The impact of the boycott of goods from Israeli-linked companies over the regions inside in Gaza is visible on the supermarket shelves. Many shoppers say their daily needs now reflect political and moral concerns. And as global brands pull back, Turkey's local companies continue to step forward. Ahmed Mahdi, Istanbul.
Well, the FIFA chief is facing a complaint over a peace prize awarded by him to the U.S. president during the World Cup draw in Washington. The complaint was filed with FIFA's ethics committee by international human rights group Fair Square. The UK-based advocacy group accused Gianni Infantino of violating FIFA's duty of neutrality. It argued that the organization's behavior goes against the common interests of the global football community. Fair Square warned that if Infantino acted unilaterally and without statutory authority, his support for Donald Trump's political agenda should be seen as an egregious abuse of power. Similarly, a New York-based rights group condemned FIFA's decision, saying there is no sign of peace and unity in the Trump administration's human rights record. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
And man was burning and keeping the light alive. A bone in his throat, a thorn in his eye. In silence, and man was burning and keeping the light.
ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين، ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Murarisi here with another special edition of this program, The Ocean of Dua. In this special edition and during this sacred and holy month of Ramadan, we'll try to talk about some parts of Iftitah supplication, and we'll be bringing you the commentary on some parts of this supplication. We'll be back again after you listen to some parts of this dua, so stay with us.
Alhamdulillah, الذي لا يهتك حجابه ولا يغلق بابه ولا يرد سائله ولا يخيب آمنه.
Praise be to Allah. No one can disclose anything hidden by him, and no one can shut the doors kept open by him, and no one who makes a request is sent away disappointed by him.
Alhamdulillah, الذي لا يهتك حجابه ولا يغلق بابه ولا يرد سائله ولا يخيب آمله.
Especially in this last part, it is saying that no one who looks long and attentively to Allah is deluded in his hopes. So, we concluded in the previous program that if a person really pins his hopes on God, no one who looks long and attentively is deluded. And so, if we become hopeless and we see such symptoms, we can realize that we have not actually pinned our hope on God. And we also concluded that it is hope that produces movements and keeps us away from inertia and laziness. So, under the pretext of relying on God, some people refuse to discharge any duty. Those people, it is really interesting, they strive neither to perform the recommended acts, those mustahabbat, as we call it, nor to avoid the dubious ones. And if you ask them, they'll go, God's mercy is infinite and he will treat us mercifully. One must not despair of God's favor. Now, do you think that their hope is greater than that of the awliya and the prophets? Notwithstanding their total reliance and trust in God, these personages would not abandon even the least of duties and responsibilities. Is our hope for God's favor greater than theirs, such that without action we hope that God will admit us into the highest heaven? Of course not. We usually imagine that we have strong trust in God, but the commander of the faithful, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, exposed the truth by saying this sentence: you have neither fear nor hope, you have no khawf, you have no raja. If you are really hopeful of God's favor, its effects must be manifested throughout your actions. So if you pin your hope on a person and expect him to do something for you, how will you behave with him? You are careful in your actions lest you annoy or irritate him. You are always showing respect to him, and etc. Would you ever dare reviling him or displaying a hostile attitude towards him? But how about your attitude toward your Creator? Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "You rely on this person concerning insignificant and trivial matters, but you are not as humble and polite to God as you are to him, although your reliance on God involves far more serious and sublime matters." Concerning which matters do you rely on a person? Trivial matters? He solves your problems, or sometimes he serves as your mediator. At most, your friend protects your honor in times of need and saves your life in times of danger so that you can live longer. In any case, all of these are limited. If you know what I'm saying, how valuable is the degree obtained by a young student who has spent the prime of his youth in studies? Is it 10 million, 1 billion, 1 trillion? No matter how much, it is limited and finite. What are we expecting from God? In comparison to that, we are expecting from God an unlimited, eternal life. Do our deeds measure up to this expectation? Do our deeds measure up to this level of wish?
The month of Ramadan is that in which was revealed the Quran, a guidance for the people and clear proofs of guidance and criterion. So whoever cites the new moon of the month, let him fast it, and whoever is ill or on a journey, then an equal number of other days. Allah intends for you ease and does not intend for you hardship, and wants for you to complete the period and to glorify Allah for that to which he has guided you, and perhaps you will be grateful.
What I'm trying to say here is, if we are really hoping for it, why is it not manifested in all our actions? It is better to be truthful to God and not deceive ourselves. God cannot be deceived, although unfortunately some people intend to deceive him. It's not what I say, it's the Holy Quran saying, يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهَ وَالَّذِينَ آمَنُوا وَمَا يَخْدَعُونَ إِلَّا أَنفُسَهُمْ وَمَا يَشْعُرُونَ. They seek to deceive Allah and those who have faith. وَمَا يَخْدَعُونَ إِلَّا أَنفُسَهُمْ. Yet they deceive no one but themselves. وَمَا يَشْعُرُونَ. But they're not aware. So we must be truthful to God. The wise man is the one who purifies his intentions and is truthful in supplicating to him. May the Almighty Allah keep us away from the ones who are deceiving themselves and trying to deceive Allah. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program as well. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Through half my life, yeah, Allah, oh Allah. Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
May peace, blessings, and God's mercy be with you all. In November 2025, Iraq held its sixth parliamentary elections since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. A total of 7,744 candidates from 31 electoral alliances competed for 329 seats for a four-year term. In these elections, several prominent Iraqi political forces presented their visions for governing the country and prioritizing reforms. Despite the differences in their rhetoric, most focused on shared concerns, such as building effective institutions, improving public services, and combating corruption. However, among the 31 alliances and approximately 7,744 candidates, hardly any address the issue of Iraqi sovereignty, which has been violated by the United States in their electoral platforms. Only a very small number of candidates, no more than a handful, mentioned this topic in scattered speeches, not in their platforms, referring to the sovereignty of a country that was invaded and besieged, where hundreds of thousands of citizens lost their lives. Following the 2003 invasion and the subsequent withdrawal in 2011, along with its return under the banner of the International Coalition in 2014, the United States has managed to exert systematic control over Iraq through a network of both visible and invisible pressure. This control is exercised through five key tools. 1. Monitoring financial flows via the U.S. Federal Reserves, effectively overseeing Iraq's dollar reserves and their overseas transfers. 2. Influence on security institutions through training programs and technical and technological support. 3. Indirect political influence by establishing relationships with influential forces and backing the so-called restructuring of the Iraqi state. 4. Influence in the oil sector, impacting contracts and terms set by American companies. 5. Military presence and threats, maintaining a military presence and making direct threats to security. For instance, the United States has imposed sanctions on Iraqi companies and individuals accused of collaborating with Iran or facilitating the evasion of American sanctions. Washington has also pressured successive Iraqi governments to sign large agreements with American companies in the energy, oil, technology, and health sectors, aiming to encircle Iraqi economic core and integrate it into the American system. The most alarming aspect is that the revenue from every barrel of oil sold by Iraq goes directly into an account at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, giving Washington control over the oil revenues that keep the Iraqi economy afloat. In the week leading up to the elections, specifically on November 6, 2025, a technical meeting took place between U.S. and Iraqi officials to discuss the features of the bilateral security relationship and the future of coalition forces in Iraq, namely the U.S. military presence, which is opposed by an Iraqi political force, highlighting the complexity of the issue. In 2020, the Iraqi parliament passed a law mandating the withdrawal of U.S. forces from Iraq, but this law has yet to be implemented. In June 2025, Iraqi airspace was completely violated by Israeli planes attacking Iran with direct support from the United States. Despite this incident, no party that participated in the parliamentary elections included an explicit clause regarding the presence of U.S. forces in Iraq. Similarly, no Iraqi bloc adopted a clause demanding the release of Iraqi funds from the control of the Federal Reserve in New York. In summary, despite a partial military withdrawal, Washington still maintains a comprehensive network of influence that spans finance, security, and international relations. This makes issues related to sovereignty sensitive or nearly impossible to raise in an electoral context. The shift in strategy from direct military means to a form of soft power, while still keeping a usable military club when necessary, has created a reality in Iraq where every political force is aware of the American red lines that cannot be crossed without significant costs. For this reason, it's not hard to see why blocs and candidates steer clear of discussing the issue of military presence and American financial dominance. This is mainly due to the fear of sanctions, financial embargoes, and the designation of factions as terrorist organizations, which could lead to direct military attacks. It's essential to remember that from 2019 to 2024, in the period following the defeat of Daesh and when the U.S. presence in Iraq was officially part of the coalition, Iraqi figures, factions, and official armed forces were subjected to declared U.S. strikes. These attacks were justified under the pretext of responding to the assault on the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad, late 2019, due to the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps of Iran, and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, head of the Popular Mobilization Unit's General Staff, early 2020. On the grounds of retaliating for an operation carried out by Iraqi factions against the U.S. military base in Jordan, early 2024. The disdain for Iraqi money in New York stems from its role as one of the most dangerous tools of American influence. 90% of Iraq's dollar transactions go through a system overseen by the United States, and any misstep or deterioration in relations could disrupt foreign transfers, limit Iraqi banking activities, or freeze a portion of reserves, as was seen on a limited basis in 2022 and 2023. In summary, the United States exerts comprehensive hegemony over Iraq in military, political, economic, and financial aspects. The reasons preventing Iraqi political forces from addressing this hegemony are the same ones that compel them to raise the issue of these archives. It's illogical for their country to be subjected to such a high level of external threats, with the United States turning their country's airspace into a corridor for Israeli planes to attack a neighboring country, while this level of danger is ignored under the pretext of American threats. The lack of candidates willing to open these files demonstrates Iraq's current weakness in the face of Washington and reveals the fragility of its security and financial stability. This silence is not due to neutrality or a matter of choice. Rather, it is a silence imposed by the equations of power and American hegemony. In this episode, we will examine the American hegemony over Iraq, a dominance whose simplest consequence is the restructuring of the Iraqi political landscape, and whose most severe outcome is the neutralization of Iraq from the causes surrounding it, which are its own. This has turned Iraq, through the direct presence of American military forces, into a platform that threatens both its own people and the nations in the region. In Geneva, Switzerland, in 1991, the then U.S. Secretary of State James Baker delivered a powerful message to Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz. Iraq will be bombed and sent back to the Stone Age. 12 years later, Baker's prophecy came true. The United States invaded Iraq following a comprehensive embargo that plunged the country into hunger, led to the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, and stripped them of their most basic human rights. While some may argue that Saddam's invasion of Kuwait justified the embargo and subsequent intervention, there are deeper reasons that warrant a thorough analysis. Italian sociologist and economic theorist Giovanni Arrighi argues that the 2003 invasion and occupation of Iraq was not merely a strategic blunder by the United States, but rather a historic turning point in the cycle of modern capitalism. According to Arrighi, Iraq signified the end of a U.S. hegemonic cycle that began in 1945. This introduction is essential for understanding the significance of Iraq, its geopolitical relevance, and the capitalist and imperialist perspectives on the country. Arrighi categorizes the history of capitalism into four cycles of hegemony: Genoese, Dutch, British, and American. In each cycle, the dominant power progresses through a series of phases. First, a phase of productive expansion. Second, a phase of financial expansion. Third, a crisis. Fourth, a war or military intervention aimed at preserving its hegemony. And fifth, a collapse. Arrighi argues that the United States entered a phase of financial crisis and debt in the 1970s, when it lost its productive edge over East Asian countries. To safeguard its financial position, it turned to its military power, and Iraq became the perfect stage to reaffirm its hegemony through force. Why Iraq? Because according to Arrighi, it was at the heart of the world's oil reserves, represented the central axis of the dollar-based financial system, and was geopolitically strategic for containing China's expansion and exerting pressure on Europe and Russia in the energy sector. Arrighi states that the wars fought by empires during their periods of weakness hastened their downfall, just as the Boer War, which occurred in South Africa in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, signaled the beginning of the end for the British Empire. Similarly, the war in Iraq, according to his theory, marked the onset of the decline of American supremacy. Arrighi believes that Washington's focus on Iraq and Afghanistan has allowed China to broaden its economic influence in Asia and Africa, forming energy alliances that attract industries and develop competitive infrastructures. In his view, China's achievements represent a structural revolution in the global economy. Arrighi sees the U.S. occupation of Iraq as part of the evolution of global capitalism and its efforts to overcome its crisis. The Arab thinker Edward Said, although he did not live to see all the consequences of the invasion and occupation, interpreted the events in Iraq since 1991 as part of the structure of Orientalist discourse. Said criticized the use of phrases like existential threat or a regime that only responds to force, which were used to construct a media narrative that justified the war, portraying Iraq not as it was, but as the United States needed it to be perceived. Additionally, in 2012, researcher and writer Christopher Doran published a study titled How Iraq Threatened the U.S. Economic Empire and Had to Be Destroyed, which largely aligns with Arrighi's theory. Doran draws a historical parallel from April 1917, when U.S. President Woodrow Wilson justified America's entry into World War I with the argument of making the world safe for democracy. However, Wilson's true motivation was to safeguard American corporate investments in Britain and France, ensuring that bankers like J.P. Morgan would recover the loans extended to these nations. From this viewpoint, World War I was fundamentally a war aimed at bolstering the security of capitalism. According to Doran, the same reasoning applies to Iraq after 1991. The suffering of the Iraqi people began with Saddam Hussein's war against Iran, followed by his invasion of Kuwait. The suffering was exacerbated during the sanctions period from 1990 to 2003. And escalated dramatically with the American invasion and occupation that is after 2003. Under the guise of a comprehensive economic reform, the United States aimed to establish the first neoliberal free market economy in West Asia, intending to monopolize the country's economic resources and investment opportunities for itself and its allies at the expense of the Iraqi people, their services, social welfare, and humanitarian needs. In the decades leading up to the suffering, Iraq stood in stark contrast to the neoliberal ideology and the model proposed by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. Iraq was a significant oil-producing nation and benefited from market manipulation and oil price increases in 1973 and beyond. However, unlike Saudi Arabia, Iraq refused to send its oil profits to the United States in exchange for protection. Instead, it invested its oil revenues in development and encouraged other Arab oil-producing countries to follow suit. Duran states in his study, following the overthrow of the monarchy in 1958 and prior to the economic sanctions, Iraq was a nation focused on two main issues, development and Arab nationalism. This country had all the necessary elements to evolve into a developed nation like those in the global north. Iraq had a skilled workforce, an industrial base, education, health care, a strong infrastructure, abundant resources, an educated middle class, and an effective state apparatus. Joint Arab economic reports published by the Arab Monetary Fund over the years confirm that between 1958 and 1978, development indicators in Iraq showed faster than usual improvements in health, education, and social conditions. Furthermore, Iraq demonstrated a remarkable ability to reduce income disparities among its population. After Saddam's war against Iran and the invasion of Kuwait, the 1991 war devastated the country's infrastructure. Sanctions from 1990 to 2003 and Western aggression destroyed Iraqi society. The U.S. invasion in 2003 dismantled the state itself, turning the country into a scene of violence and collapse. Today, in 2025, 22 years after the invasion, the overthrow of Saddam and the lifting of sanctions, Iraq's electricity crisis continues. According to Christopher Duran, in the year 2000, Iraq directly challenged one of the foundations of American global dominance by refusing to accept dollars. This move made a military response from the United States unavoidable. One of the most crucial elements of the global economy and U.S. hegemony was the petrodollar, the requirement that oil, the world's most vital commodity, be sold exclusively in dollars. Following the invasion in June 2003, the U.S. military occupation resumed the sale of Iraqi oil in dollars. This military invasion followed the United States not only to take control of Iraqi oil, but also to ensure the continuation of the neoliberal agenda, dismantling the state, minimizing the role of government, and privatizing public services. These are core principles of neoliberalism. In a similar vein, and placing the war against Iraq within the framework of the global capitalist crisis, American Marxist thinker and political theorist David North published an article in 2010 titled "The Crisis of American Capitalism and the War Against Iraq." North argues that Saddam's regime was, in part, a byproduct of the bloody U.S. interventions during the 1950s, 1960s, and 1970s, which aimed to eliminate the socialist labor movement in West Asia, a significant political force in the region. The question of the United States' role in the rise of Ba'athists in Iraq is debatable, particularly regarding the coup on February 8, 1963, which overthrew the nationalist and leftist regime of Abdul Karim Qasim and brought the Ba'athists to power with CIA support. However, David North contends that the primary goal of the United States was to control Iraq's oil reserves. He adds that all attempts to deny the crucial role of oil in the U.S. efforts to invade Iraq reek of falsehood and absurdity. No other natural resource has influenced U.S. imperialist political and economic calculations in the past century as much as oil and natural gas. When discussing oil, it's important to highlight that Central America's interest in crude is not just about ensuring profits for the massive U.S. oil companies, the U.S. industry, the stability of its financial structure, and its dominant global position rely on unrestricted access and control over the vast oil resources of the Persian Gulf and, more recently, the Caspian Sea Basin. According to North, the history of U.S. foreign policy and military strategy before 2010 can be examined from a purely economic viewpoint as a response to the oil crisis of 1973, which occurred after the conflict between the Israeli occupying entity and Egypt, Syria, along with several supporting Arab states. North argues that this event had a significant impact on the U.S. economy and the global capitalist economy. The second oil crisis following the Iranian Revolution of 1979 led to the Carter Doctrine, which stated that unrestricted access to the Persian Gulf was a vital strategic concern for the United States. This in turn paved the way for the large-scale deployment of U.S. military forces in our region. The straightforward historical explanation, which places the war against Iraq in its economic context, brings us to the present day, where the United States continues to control Iraqi resources and plays a crucial role in the balance of power and wealth distribution in the region. In an article titled Eight Reasons Why the United States and Iraq Still Need Each Other, published by David Pollack on the Washington Institute's website in 2020, two key points were identified that highlight the economic interests of the United States in Iraq and justify its ongoing presence. One, the energy and financial value. Pollack stated that in addition to Iraq's geostrategic and political value, the country is now one of the largest oil exporters in the world, with vast long-term reserves. He argued that if the U.S. presence remains as it is, the economies of the United States, Iraq, and the global economy will collectively benefit from these resources. As was his custom before his death in 2024, Pollack used the Iranian spectrum to justify the ongoing U.S. occupation of Iraq. He argued that if the United States withdrew, Iran would effectively increase its control over Iraq's vast energy and financial resources, hindering their use in Iraqi development projects to evade sanctions and promote its hegemonic ambitions. Two, Iraq as a regional counterbalance. The second point he raised also fits within the same context, stating that the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries were expected to start supplying electricity to Iraq in 2020 to lessen its independence on Iranian supply. According to Pollack, if the United States continued to be involved in the events, Iraq could shift from being a threat to becoming a partner with other Arab allies in the region. However, if the United States withdrew, some governments of the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council and their populations might view Iraq as an even more subordinate state to Iran, either due to its Shiite majority or the departure of the main counterbalancing power. Furthermore, these governments' willingness to rely on the already questionable American guarantees would diminish even more after the withdrawal. All of this would increase the pressure on the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council countries to appease Iran, thus snatching a U.S. defeat from the jaws of victory. It's important to emphasize that although Pollack was an outspoken Zionist, his arguments reflect the true mindset of the U.S. administration and institutions to maintain their military presence in Iraq even under the guise of containing Iran. What has been presented so far illustrates the centrality of Iraq and its oil to the global capitalist system and specifically to U.S. hegemony over our country and the world. It's worth noting that since the 2003 invasion, the United States has exerted dominant control over the Iraqi oil sector. Four American companies, Coastal, Phoenix, Chevron, and Mobil, have taken on the management, investment, and marketing of a significant portion of the country's oil wealth. Many of the signed agreements have been illegal and unconstitutional. A recent example occurred in May 2025, when the Iraqi Kurdistan region announced contracts worth $110 billion with the American companies HKN Energy and Western Zagros despite the opposition from the Ministry of Oil in Baghdad, which declared them invalid. The ministry reminded that natural resources belong to all Iraqis and that any investment agreement must be managed through the federal government in Baghdad, in accordance with the law and the Constitution. On that day, in a speech delivered in Washington, Masoud Barzani, the Prime Minister of the Iraqi Kurdistan region, announced these agreements in a context where the United States supported the supply of oil and energy in the Kurdistan region. Meanwhile, Washington was preventing Baghdad from importing energy from Iran, citing compliance with sanctions. The United States refused to renew a waiver that allowed Iraq to purchase Iranian electricity without facing repercussions. This issue was also used as a pressure tool before the Iraqi parliamentary elections of 2025, aiming to facilitate foreign companies' control over the Iraqi electricity sector. The oil sector is the clearest evidence of U.S. dominance over Iraq, but another equally important aspect is the financial sector and the control of the dollar. Since 2003, Washington has been managing Iraq's oil export revenues by keeping these funds, the proceeds from oil sales, in accounts at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It's essential to remember that UN Security Council Resolution 1483 from 2003 mandated that revenues from Iraqi oil and gas exports be deposited into a special account known as the Development Fund for Iraq. A significant portion of this fund was allocated to pay $53 billion to Kuwait as compensation for the losses incurred during the war imposed by Saddam. It's important to highlight that the UN Security Council Resolution 1483 did not mention the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States as the custodian of these funds. However, Iraqi oil revenues are directly deposited into this account in New York. As of today, December 2025, Iraq continues to face restrictions on these funds, sometimes under the guise of combating terrorism and money laundering, and at other times under the pretext of protecting Iraq itself from lawsuits filed against it since the 1990s. In summary, the United States uses this fund, which is held in a New York bank, to manage Iraqi funds, oversee their usage, and employ them for political blackmail. It's important to note that despite this stringent American oversight, Iraq continues to be linked with corruption and embezzlement. This raises a crucial question. How is it possible that under such strict financial control, Iraqi officials managed to smuggle millions, even billions of dollars, out of the country? Beyond this contradiction, Iraq's financial situation today, in December 2025, remains questionable. Despite the accumulation of oil revenues in the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, which has reached $120 billion, Iraq faces a growing debt equivalent to the same amount, over $100 billion. Iraq's inability to manage its own finances hinders reconstruction and long-term development, forcing successive Iraqi governments to rely on international loans. Ironically, Iraq has also become one of the largest holders of U.S. Treasury bonds, with a total value reaching $41 billion in 2023. This means that instead of investing its money in profitable businesses or internal development projects, Iraq purchased U.S. bonds, effectively lending $41 billion to the United States. This investment in bonds does not yield the high returns that the Iraqi people could have achieved if their government had invested these funds in productive sectors or large tech companies. To further illustrate the ability of the United States to influence Iraqi decision-making, it's important to note that in July 2024, the Central Bank of Iraq halted all foreign transactions in Chinese currency due to pressure from the U.S. Federal Reserve. This action was taken because the United States viewed payments in currencies other than the dollar as a threat to its financial debt.